So this weekend we're speaking about the teachings of shunyata or emptiness that refer to the lack of any enduring essence or entity within any phenomena, but most particularly within this package that we call myself, this body and mind, this conjunction of this display of this conjunction of conditions, physical and mental, that propel us through life, that is so easy to get attached to and identified with as being something solid, enduring, intransigent, unmalleable, the me in there. And the teachings of shunyata are important because when we hear that through the Buddha's power of mind and depth of understanding, he was able to disentangle the attachment to and the threads that weave this tapestry of me and my life into existence. And he was able to peel away the illusion created by these multiple strands of threads of attachment of one form or another. And when we hear that, it sounds implausible and counterintuitive and not our experience. But as I demonstrated yesterday in talking about our understanding of the sun not actually revolving around the earth, but the earth spinning on an axis, creating the illusion of the sun revolving around the earth, that when we have the correct knowledge, we can then see and understand things with the right view. And I mentioned yesterday that right view in the Buddha's teaching involves this understanding, that this conjunction, this matrix of mental and physical stuff really holds no enduring thing to which it is all happening. And he also said that the wrong view of this personality has been the most pervasive, extensive, enduring cause of the suffering of humankind. So if that's true, and we can begin to see some of that in our own practice, then it really makes sense to invest some time in learning about the teachings of shunyata and practicing in such a way as to reveal that to ourselves. So yesterday I was talking also about what are called the five niyama, N-I-Y-A-M-A, niyama, the five natural order of things that the Buddha talked about, the natural order of the physical universe, the physical, chemical laws of nature, if you will. He's also talking about the biological and botanical laws of nature, the life of seeds propagating their own kind, you know, in due time with right conditions, and how those laws have been articulated because people have observed, oh, this is the way it is. With this kind of seed, if you do this, you get this kind of result. And having observed that over the course of hundreds of years or hundreds of trials, if you will, thousands, then someone is able to articulate, oh, this is the law of nature. This is the law of seeds. This is the law of, well, gravity and every other natural, physical, biological, botanical law that we also are heir to. We can't deny them, we can't oppose them, we can't get rid of them. We have to live in alignment with them. And to the extent that we understand these laws, that we have the knowledge of these laws, we can act in our life in a way to live in alignment with them. And if we do choose to live in alignment with the laws of nature as we have understood them, then we will enhance our sense of well-being and we will minimize our suffering. And this is wisdom. The Buddha didn't stop with the biological, botanical, natural laws of nature. He also understood through his direct observation, and it's been confirmed by hundreds of thousands, millions of men and women, monks and nuns, practitioners since the time of the Buddha, that there's also a series or a sequence of the laws of nature affecting or conditioning the unfolding of the mind. So that's what I want to speak about today. The three niyama, that the three natural orders of things that deal with the unfolding of the mind, so that we can hear, acquire this knowledge, and then use it in our practice, in our life, to guide our decisions, and to the extent that we understand, practice, see for ourselves, really come to believe it from our own experience, we will enhance our well-being and minimize our suffering. And this is the development of wisdom. Okay. So the three niyama of the mind are karma, the law of cause and effect, or intention. The second is citta, which is consciousness, and the flowing on of consciousness, and how it there is a natural order to the flowing on of consciousness. And then the third of the mental niyama is dhamma. There are dhamma, laws of nature, that we display in our behavior, or that we see in the behavior of all phenomena. And these also can be very liberating to learn about, observe in practice, and apply in life. So the first is karma. Karma, we've all heard of karma. Karma is the law of cause and effect, or the moral law of cause and effect. It has, it posits that, you know, the quality of the intention with which you think, speak, and act conditions the quality of the resultant effect of that thought, speech, and action. Wholesome, meaning thoughts, actions, speech, that comes from a place of care, concern, generosity, understanding, compassion. Wholesome, in that sense, meaning minimizing suffering, leads to, or conditions, pleasant results. If we act with a sense of, or coming from a place of kindness, generosity, compassion, understanding, the results will be pleasant no matter what the result is. Even if you fail utterly in accomplishing what you think you were trying to do, it's the quality of your intention that will condition and deeply imprint the mind on the mind. Now, when we talk about the law of karma, we're not talking about any magical thing out there. We're talking about the mind, the malleability of the mind. When we act, when we speak, when we do whatever we do, we're dealing with the mind. And everything we do makes its mark on the mind. Let's not say the brain. It's not the brain. It's on the mind. So every time we have a generous thought and follow through with an act of generosity, even if the person who receives the gift is really resentful and indignant and, you know, upset because it wasn't what they expected or as much as they expected or whatever, whatever. If you're genuinely coming from a place of letting go and with a motivation to relieve suffering, you can feel good about that. I mean, you might adjust your next gift to that person, but that's wisdom. So, but it's not that the action out there or the result out there is what you get back for the result of the karma. It's in here. It's in the mind. The result of karma is in the mind. It's not in the world as far as material, personal stuff. It's in the mind, how it affects the mind. The result comes to the mind. And the result is either one of more happiness or supporting happiness or undermining happiness and well-being. That's the result of karma. We can see a certain, even with a superficial understanding of our own mind, we can see that there's a certain continuity to our mental habits. You know, we get, well, I don't need to explain the obvious. If you have habits, where do habits come from? Well, they come from the mind. They're embedded in the mind. You know, and sometimes we act them out behaviorally or misbehaviorally in a certain way, but we only act because of the impulse to act in the mind. So when we talk about habits, we're talking about the mind. Habits are a display of what is called in the Buddhist teachings continuity conditioning. The first time you do something, never been done before, wow, it takes a lot of intention, it takes a lot of encouragement, it takes a lot of knowledge, it takes a lot of energy, it takes a lot of reflection, it takes a lot to do something the first time, whether it's wholesome or unwholesome. To do it the second time takes a lot, but not as much. And it's not too many times repeating a familiar or similar event, action, thought, behavior, that the momentum of the continuity carries the action. Right? And if you want to break a habit, it takes a lot of energy to exercise restraint or whatever it is to break it the first time, and a little bit less the next time, the next time, the next time, the next time. And in time we can, well, overcome bad habits, cultivate good habits, and in the process the quality of the mind changes in the direction that we can't say we determine, but that we choose moment by moment. But all of us have tried to kind of temper our bad habits and have discovered just how challenging that is. It's not easy, right? It's not only me that finds it hard, right? Okay. No, I mean, it's like because the mind is so deeply imprinted in this lifetime and maybe from other lifetimes if you have that spectrum of understanding in your mind. It's like, wow, we've been moving on this particular track for a long time, however long is for you, this lifetime or multiple lifetimes. Okay. There is this teaching in the Buddha's understanding of mind about mental legacy. Just as throughout human evolution on the face of the earth, the gene pool has undergone dramatic transformation. And in some inscrutable but obvious way, the genes that support life on Earth in the 20th century have predominated, and those that were dysfunctional 10,000 years ago, 100,000 years ago, have been eliminated, or at least no longer play such a key part in the human genome. And it's interesting, some of the research that the Human Genome Project is revealing is how, you know, I read one really interesting report. The famine in, you know, the potato famine in Ireland back whenever it was shows up in obesity in their great-great-grandchildren. Okay. That's what we're dealing with in the human genome. And much more sophisticated and intricate conditioning of our personal gene. sequence. Just as we have a personal gene sequence, we also have, from the Buddha's understanding, we would call it a mental gene sequence. And I want to talk about it kind of in terms of, playfully, in terms of Buddhist personality types. Because as we have moved through lives, we have picked and chosen and selected different mental habits which exert their repetitive, recurring, habitual force on the mind of the zygote when the sperm and the egg hit, boom, and consciousness, the stream of consciousness, arrives there with the momentum of that mind and the habits of that mind. So, what does our mental legacy look like? Well, the first of the mental legacies is karma. We come into the world with mental qualities, physical capacities, predispositions, just, you know, some people are sickly, some people are healthy, some people are wealthy, some people are not, some people are really bright, some people are really dull. And, you know, it's not, you know, it's, you know, the old nature-nurture dialogue. We come in with a package, and nurturing and the quality of our conditioning and family and culture and society and neighborhood has its effect, but cannot erase the power and the momentum of the mental qualities that we bring in. Okay, so we understand the karmic profile based on volitions in the past. The second, now, you know, it's really interesting. When I and others give a talk on karma in a retreat, you know, we talk about the wholesome karma and the unwholesome karma, but people remember the unwholesome karma. They forget. They don't think. They don't build in the same understanding of wholesome karma. And now we're living here in the West. We're all, well, healthy enough to be here. We all have the discretionary time to be here. We have the discretionary income to be here. And we have the mental capacity to kind of understand some of what's being said. All of this is a result of a mountain, just a mountainous amount of wholesome karmic actions in the past. As bad as it is for you, we're still living at the top of the heap. Okay. So, yeah, bad karma's around, but let's not overlook the obvious results of this tremendous good karma that we have. Also, good karma results coming to us in this very life. So the second mental legacy, area of mental legacy, is we all come in with a parami profile. It just says we have a genetic profile. We have a profile of our paramis. Now, the paramis are those 10 qualities of mind that the bodhisattva has to perfect in order to become a Buddha. They are the qualities of mind that we also develop to support insight and liberation. You want to know how deep your insight is? Check your paramis. You know, and to the extent that your paramis are developed, you have more capacity for liberating insight. Sounds so easy. Well, the paramis are not. But we all know these qualities. Generosity, energy, loving-kindness, patience, equanimity, renunciation, determination, and others. And if you're at all honest with yourself, you know where you lie on the spectrum of very tolerant and patient and not so tolerant, not so patient. As all of you probably know by now, I was born without the patience gene. it's my lifetime practice, developing patience. And, you know, it's, I mean, I can't say I'm proud of that, but I recognize it. You know, I don't take it personally because I know that the quality or the development of the parami patient, patience parami in this stream of consciousness can change. It can be worked with. And a lifetime of practicing patience will leave a momentum in this mind stream of great benefit to whoever picks up this stream of consciousness after I leave the earth. Right? That's why we do this practice. You know, make it better for the next person. Okay. So, when we look at our life as well, as we never stop doing, it is helpful to look at it through the lens of the paramis. And because these are the wholesome qualities of mind, and to act on them is all wholesome karmic actions, and we don't need to be defeated by the current state of our parami profile. But we understand that if there is a deficiency in one of the paramis, there are innumerable practices for strengthening and developing it. And we don't have to go ordain, we don't have to go on retreat. Is there ever a time, is there ever a day in your life where you don't have the opportunity to practice patience? Or you don't have the opportunity to practice loving kindness with some difficult person? Or where there isn't the need for calling forth a little more energy, a little more balanced energy? Or being generous? Gosh, I've been riding around with my host in Seattle this weekend to get from airport to here and back and forth and whatnot. Every intersection, there's somebody with a sign. Homeless, handout please. You know, we have more than enough opportunities to practice generosity, both adventitiously like that when you come to the intersection, but proactively in our own mind if we want to find a worthy recipient, and anyone can be a worthy recipient of our generosity, to develop that quality of mind. So we have, we're not victimized by our genetic profile, we're not victimized by our parami profile. There are opportunities. And if we understand what our parami profile is, we can honestly look at it, review it, and say, you know, I need to do some work here, and this one's got some momentum, let that, you know, we'll keep nudging that along, but let's pick up the ball on this one. And in that way we can, well, over the course of a lifetime of knowledge of the paramis, intentional actions and development of the paramis, develop a tremendous amount of wisdom and understanding, which is also one of the paramis. And that's why we study the paramis or learn about the paramis, so that we can bring them more consciously into our life and change the parami profile of this stream of consciousness. It's so easy to look at ourselves or another and say, what an impatient person. You know, I do this to myself. My wife does it also. And to just feel defensive and resistant to that appraisal is not very useful. But to buy into it with a defeated mentality is not very useful, is also not useful. It takes a balance of mind. It takes awareness to see, oh, this is the way it is. Neither to buy into it, nor to deny it. But to see, oh, this is the way it is, and that's what mindfulness does. Mindfulness doesn't apply value and meaning, it just sees, oh, this is the way it is. And that's why mindfulness is so important as a practice in life. And not just with your eyes closed, but in everything you do in life, every action, every daily moment, to bring mindfulness to it is an attempt to honestly appraise the present moment as it is for you. And if you do that, if you can do that, then you're more likely to have a skillful response to those conditions rather than a unskillful, habitual, following the momentum of your mind, reaction to it. Because without awareness, without mindfulness, you don't know what's going on. Your habits will control the day. The momentum of your mind will carry on as it is. And if you have a strong parami profile, that's great. It'll carry on. But if we don't keep feeding it, it'll gradually run down or wear out or be replaced by the degradation of the paramis. So it's good to look at the, to know, to be familiar with, and to honestly appraise your, kind of like the baseline of the paramis in your life. And then to choose your practices to address the deficiencies or to enhance those that are out of balance or weakest. The third of the paramis are the wholesome qualities of mind that are recurring and habitual in the mind. The third mental legacy is what is called the anusya profile. And this is the catalog of latent defilements in the mind. The potential latent defilements lying in the mind that we, you know, this particular mind stream is most susceptible to. There are seven of them. Luckily, there's 10 paramis, but there's only 7 anusyas. You know, if you were a politician counting votes, you know, we'll get to that person, that type here in a minute. But when we talk about anusya profile, we're talking about the potential in the mind to be activated by conditions in an unwholesome way. For example, there's the greedy type. The type that wants more sensual pleasure. And to evaluate your own index on this spectrum, what do you do when you get a catalog in the mail? If your index of being a greedy, sensual type is very high, and you're very susceptible to that quality of mind, you will, well, won't even get out of the post office before you're looking at it to kind of see if there's anything in there that you haven't needed for 35, 40, 50 years, but now you do. That's a pretty high index, right? And then there's others, like myself, that try to drop them in the garbage at the post office before Kamala sees it. Because we have we're on different ends of the spectrum on this index. And she knows it, and I know it, and we have this mutual understanding that this is what we came into the world with, and this is what we're working with. So it's really important to understand, to honestly appraise your susceptibility to being seduced by the sensual pleasures. Now, we all have it. I mean, we all like to be comfortable. We all like good food. We all like good music. We all like comfortable surroundings. We all like nice clothes, a nice house, a nice... But, okay, that's not the problem. It's when it gets activated and causes suffering, or when we can't get it, when we can't get the sensual pleasure that we want, it causes suffering. That's when it's a problem. So it's important to, as I said, honestly appraise your susceptibility to external conditions activating your sensual desire that then, because it's such a strong habit in the mind, it's very easy to follow through with. Okay? And to undertake the practices that can minimize or at least weaken that habit in the mind. Other latent defilements to keep an eye on or to appraise, of course, is aversion. Any kind of impatience, being short-tempered. But aversion also covers a wide spectrum of states of mind. Not only anger, rage, blame, impatience, but also disappointment, frustration, despair, depression. These are all forms or manifestations of an aversive state of mind. So how susceptible are you when you read when you read the news? What is your reaction? Is it one of indignation and anger? Well, if you understand that you have this index of aversion in your anousia profile, how often do you want to read the news? How many times a day you got to go hit the, you know, reread the headlines? Well, it's our choice, isn't it? We have a choice to strengthen this habit of aversion, or we have the potential to weaken this habit of aversion. And it's within our own mind. It's within our own intention. It's within our own awareness if we know this. If we don't know this, and we don't practice awareness, we're going to keep strengthening the momentum of the unwholesome defilements as a potential in the mind. So there's the greedy type, greedy sensual type, the aversive type, and then, of course, the deluded type. And if you don't know which type you are, you're that one. But as Manindra said, it's not like we're just one or the other. That would be bad enough. We have all three. And so it's better to kind of imagine, you know, the index from being very deluded to very wise, and where on the spectrum are you today? I'm sure you have friends or you have acquaintances or people that you work with that are very indecisive, that just can't get, just don't think clearly. And no fault of theirs, that's just the momentum of the mind. And, you know, or other people who are very sharp, quick on the uptake, really clear and decisive. They may make wrong decisions, but, you know, they have that quality of mind. So it's important, again, to really appraise your... And the thing is, an appraisal at this time, we have to be careful not to solidify a sense of self around it. Now, this is the danger of talking about it this way. Greedy type, aversive type, a deluded type. Which am I? Oh, I'm a deluded type. Oh, I'm a really deluded type. I'm forever going to be a deluded type. I'm always a deluded type. I am deluded. Just call me Mr. Deluded. You know, I mean, it's a very slippery slope from feeling impatient to thinking, oh, I'm always impatient, to solidifying a sense of self like I'm an impatient person, which is a long ways away from a moment of experiencing impatience. But that the slope is very quick. The mind runs very quickly from a moment of impatience to I'm an impatient person and always will be. And, you know, feeling, well, victimized by that. So we want to be really careful in developing awareness of these mental legacies and profiles, not to solidify a sense of self around it, but to be honest, to have an appraisal, and to understand that practice, there are practices to strengthen all of the paramis and to weaken all of the anusyas. So we have the greedy type, the aversive type, the deluded type, which are fairly obvious, except to the deluded types. And then we have another four. There are those who are, we say, greedy for life. They just want more life. They want everything. They want all the experiences of life. They're not just happy just living their life. They want to live everybody else's life, too, and forever. Now, do you have that quality? Let me just ask. How far into the future do your plans extend? You know, do you forget to remind yourself that it's only if you're alive then? You know, I mean, we make plans, more plans, than we would ever be able to live out in a dozen lifetimes. Right? We make all kinds of plans. We have all kinds of aspirations, hopes, dreams that we could never satisfy in this lifetime. And if we don't satisfy them or let go of them, we'll be back and have another opportunity to fulfill them, during which we will continue to have more plans, more ideas of the future, and we'll plant those seeds, and if we don't fulfill them in that lifetime, we'll come back and get another chance. This is called samsara. Looking for happiness in all the wrong places, mostly out in the future, because that's not where it's at. So if we have this kind of a high index of the desire for continued life, then we'll be, you know, active schemers and strategizers and planners and imagining ourselves in other ways of being endlessly into the future. Now, we all do that to some degree, but if we see that, oh, this is not a particularly skillful thing to be doing because it actually is planting the seed of unhappiness. Oh, it's planting the seed of happiness if you can fulfill it, but it takes a lot to do that. So let's have an honest appraisal of that. There's three others. One is conceit, the underlying tendency to conceit. And this can best be seen in how you evaluate or compare yourself with others. This is a politician mentality. You know, counting votes. And you can see it yourself. You know, you see someone, and there's almost instantly there's an appraisal of yourself in how you reflect on them. Better than, worse than, equal to, same as. Now, you know, we're not doing it all the time, but we do have that tendency. You know, somebody gets a new car, they get a promotion, they do this, you know. I have a leather jacket there that I got a couple years ago, and Rich was telling me, oh, what was it? Something like, oh, this is a greed inducer. It's like, greed generating device. It's like, yeah, I want that. You know? and we do it. I mean, it's like we are susceptible to that kind of comparing mind that conditions a sense of ourself. And then that sense of self that gets conditioned by this comparing mind feels solid. Feels like, oh, that's who I really am. I am better than. I am not as good as. I am equal to. And this is a tendency that we all have. And it can be either stronger or weaker. But we want to be aware that this is a habit, a potential habit of mind, and be on guard for it. Be mindfully aware of it. Having heard about it, we want to be aware of it. The sixth anusya profile index is doubt. Doubt can manifest, of course, in any number of ways. Doubt about oneself, doubt about others. A lot of lack of confidence, a lot of mistrust, a lot of indecision, similar to delusion. And it's not that we're ever going to be doubt-free, but if it's keeping us stuck, if we're stuck in a doubting, indecisive, lack of trust of others, self, unwilling to take risks, this has its consequences. You know, we can stay stuck in an unhealthy and an unpleasant, unhappy state of mind for a long period of times until we deal with doubt, until we learn how to deal with doubt. Accept the fact that doubt's there and still act in the world. And the last that I'll speak about, but maybe the most important in terms of all of them, is the tendency to wrong view. And I spoke about wrong view earlier, but in this case it means the tendency to assume that whatever's going on is actually happening due to this entity in here. Due to me, it's reflecting me, it's strengthening the sense of, a solid sense of self. And we buy into that a lot. So we want to be careful. Or just be aware, just be alert that, oh, this habit of mind can get activated by anything. And when we see that, then we can address it with awareness and right view. And the Buddha has lots of advice for how to deal with wrong view and how to cultivate right view. How are we doing on time? So the fourth mental legacy, the fourth index that we have a quality on is what's called charita, mentality. It's kind of like, charita means like the way you go, something like that. And this is where the greedy, aversive, deluded type of personality type in Buddhist understanding comes from. But it's a little incomplete because there's not only three Buddhist personality types, charitas, there's six. And the other three are associated with the three that we're familiar with, the greed, aversive, deluded types. So I want to speak about those a little bit. The fourth type, which is associated with the greed type, is the faith type. Both faith and greed look for things to be attached to or to have faith in. So they're looking for these things, these pleasant things, pleasant faith, behavior to have faith in someone, or pleasant thing to be greedy and attached to. So if one is a greedy type, or to address one's greedy type, if you practice, it will turn into or become more of a faith type. Not that you acquire the person that you have faith in or the practice that you have faith in, but you have more less susceptibility to the greedy type, and the beneficial greedy type is having faith in oneself, faith in one's practice, faith in one's teacher, faith in one's decisions, really. The corollary to the aversive type is the wisdom type. And it's, you know, they say, oh, aversive types get enlightened quicker. Why? Well, because when one is in an aversive mode and you're averse to someone, you're irritated with them or whatever, and you look at them, man, all you can see is infinite little things to be irritated about. You know, like the way they comb, you know, you're irritated, you're angry about something, but you're also irritated by the way they comb their hair and the color of clothes they wear and, you know, their haircut, and it's like everything. You get very refined discrimination with aversion, right? It's like every little thing. Well, that capacity for very refined discrimination, when developed through practice, results in discriminating wisdom. Very refined distinction between which course of behavior or which state of mind is wholesome or unwholesome. What is a wise action or response, and what is a less wise action or response. And so it's the quality, the capacity of very refined discrimination, which when unwholesome is aversion, when wholesome is wisdom. Okay? And the corollary to the deluded type is what is called the vitakka type, the type of mind that can pick up an idea and can stick with it and consider it and think about it and work on it and can comprehensively come to understand something, which is the opposite of delusion. Delusion is just kind of blah, 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 not very accurate. and so has a very, very fully developed but wrong understanding of something, where the vitakka type with mindfulness and awareness develops a elaborated knowledge of what it is looking at. And this is a wholesome state of mind. So this is the fourth spectrum of, you know, what I've been thinking of doing is drawing up a questionnaire, you know, and kind of have, where it can evaluate, or people can self-evaluate all of these different, where they fall on the spectrum of all these mental things, and then you can taunt each other with it. And the fifth mental legacy is of our likes and dislikes, and it's our preferences for or against things, people, events, beliefs. Did you ever wonder why those people in the other political party have the thoughts and beliefs that they do? Unreasonable. Right? I'm not saying which one that is, but because I know there are Democrats that actually practice the Dharma also. Right? Okay. So, and the likes and preferences are just intractable. You know, you may notice that, you know, you're still liking, attracted to, indulging in things that you picked up in your early adulthood that no longer serve you. It's like behaviors, beliefs, friends, you know, misbehaviors, whatever, that were useful at one time, were beneficial, were necessary at one time, and they are not supporting your life now, not supporting your aspiration. But the momentum, the recurring momentum and the habit of those likes and dislikes persists. Right? It's not you. It's just a habit. We say, you know, when asked the question, well, who makes the decisions to do this, to do that, whatever? If you're aware, wisdom makes the decision. If you're not aware, habit makes the decision. Again, this is why awareness is so important. If we're not aware, habit, the momentum of all these habits, these repetitions, these recurring momentum of the mind will make your decisions. And you'll just strengthen that track in the mind. Now, you know, neuroscientists studying the mind, you know, have realized, that the mind is plastic. You know, there's a lot of plasticity in the mind. You can change the mind. You can change the shape, the size. You can change the texture. You can change the momentum of the mind. Wow, imagine that. You know, the Buddha understood that a while ago. And I think those of us who practice have seen it, you know, in our own mind, that, oh, things, you know, maybe not on a single retreat, but, you know, you can see the possibility on a single retreat. And if you practice for a decade, or you practice for two or three, as some of you have, the mind, quite different. The capacity of the mind, the momentum of the mind, quite different. So imagine a lifetime of practice. Anything less, not going to get the job done. And then the last of the six mental legacies is what's called vasana, our tendencies. And it is for this package, the natural or the prevailing movement towards something, or it's a characteristic likelihood that one will tend this way. One will tend towards this kind of response, tend towards this kind of behavior, tend towards this kind of state of mind. Or it's a predisposition to think, act, and behave in a particular way, in a particular fashion. A predisposition. Now, it's a predisposition just like our genetics may have a kind of a genetic loading for some disease. But if you carefully live a lifestyle to minimize the support for activating that genetic loading, then the disease doesn't happen. Well, so too in this mental gene pool. if we know, if we can recognize and we can see in ourselves a tendency to, and it's almost having the strength of predetermined or predestined to do that, if we buy into the belief of predestined life, we're stuck. But if we buy into, if we understand the plasticity of the mind, then even though there's a strong compulsion, strong urge, strong tendency to go in that direction, if it's unwholesome and you understand that from your own practice, you don't have to go there. But what the Buddha is saying here is that there can be very, very strong momentum or tendency towards certain course of action. It's not predetermined. Some religions believe that it is predetermined and you don't have any choice. You have to live it out. Well, the Buddha said, no, while there is a strong momentum, it's not predetermined. You can actually, through the development of awareness and wisdom, you can affect, you can condition the unfolding of the momentum of the mind. So we're neither omnipotent in being able to control our life and the momentum of our life, but neither are we just victimized by the momentum or the mental legacy that we come into life with. So we should understand that through practice, and we become aware of these potentials in the mind or this legacy in the mind, then we can do something about it. If we don't understand this, if we don't hear about this, if we don't understand this, we don't look for this in our life, habit will rule the day. Good luck. In the Devata Samyutta Sutta, the Buddha said, a living being is run and regulated by the mind. All phenomena that constitutes a living being follows the wishes of a single phenomena, the mind. Really important to practice awareness and to come to understand the mind, because it is what moves this mind and body through life, planting, strengthening the momentum or of wholesome and or strengthening the momentum of unwholesome. That's why we're here, right?